Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for January 13th, 2011. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Ben Philpott from KUT News and the Tribune.
Hello.
And sitting in for Evan today is Reeve Hamilton.
Hey there.
Wearing a tie even. How about that?
Yeah, Reeve has been dressed up this week.
It's the first time I've ever worn a tie for the Tribcast.
I like to say, if you're going to be in Evan's chair, you got to wear a tie.
I like it when Reeve's on the podcast because I get a promotion to the next to last person mentioned.
Well, everyone who listens to us should know the legislature gaveled in this week, and we have plenty to talk about. I just wanted to get, for our first topic, sort of get y'all's impressions on opening day.
Well, you know, the House always lets the air out of the tires. They build up, they give you this big build up, and it's going to be a really, really nasty fight, and it's going to be great if you're a mook and you like these kinds of things, and then there's no fight at all. So Warren Chisholm gets out of the speaker's race the night before. Ken Paxton walks up right before the vote and says, you know, I'm not going to run after all. And gosh darn it, it's going to be...
Wah-wah. Yeah, wah-wah. That was about it.
Exactly.
At least the Senate is honest, you know. They don't make any claim that they're not going to be boring on the first day of session.
That is true. I wandered over to the Senate side, you know, halfway through the House's five nominating speeches for Strauss. I decided just to go check out what was happening over there in the Senate. And Steve Ogden was already talking about the permanent school fund.
Right.
And, wow. You know.
Target revenue.
Target revenue, whatever that means.
Yeah, he had to get up there to give a speech to accept the sort of honorary position, President Pro Tem. And he just starts going into, we need to change Medicaid. Here are your holes in the budget. It was very wonky.
Right, the wonkin' chief, you know, he's the but they had the 30 nominating speeches before that, right?
No, because he requested that they limit the number of speeches, so they had three.
Oh, that's pretty smart. Put it in the can. Usually there's 30 senators talking about what a great man the president pro tem of the moment is, and you know, it goes on.
And it's all for reasons like, well, he grew up in Abilene, so you know, he's going to be good at this.
He's walked on sand and on dust. That's so. Crazy. And so nothing happens in the legislature for a couple of months now. I mean, it's this really weird thing where there's this bang, and then they'll start to work quietly on the budget. They'll be working quietly on redistricting. They'll be fiddling with bills. But unless there are emergencies, the Constitution doesn't let them vote on legislation for the first 60 days. So until mid-March, we're really sort of fixing.
And obviously, when the Constitution was written, I believe 5,000 years ago. But I may be off a few
years. Right after the Earth cooled.
Exactly. But that's 11,000 years. Come on. Anyway, they wrote it with the idea of, you know, you had to let bills lay out. People had to get in their horse and buggy and travel from El Paso to be able to read these bills. So somebody suggested today, hey, maybe they should move it to 30 days after the session starts. And then somebody else besides said, no. Then we would get to more bills.
Right.
So we're still constitutionally there's a constitutionally mandated calendar that basically prevents lawmakers from hearing a lot of
things up.
Right.
And some say, well, that's a good thing. You know, the whole, as I think actually Ross said this to me last session, the whole infrastructure of the legislature is designed to keep bills from passing.
Right.
Well, not any of these new young people, but there are some old legislators that still use a horse and buggy.
Well, that's true. I forgot about that. Yes.
They use the young people.
Let's jump straight into this budget shortfall that could be as high as $27 billion. We got the revenue estimate from Susan Combs on Monday. Ben, I know you've been kind of talking to some folks about this.
Well, you know, it is... So there is no actual deficit or
shortfall.
It's just what we think we should have to spend based on what you think you should spend on maintaining what the state is already doing, adding enrollment growth, adding population growth, adding all that stuff. CPPP says you add all those numbers together and we need $27 billion more than what the comptroller says we have.
Right. What they did was the Center for Public Policy Priorities took the legislative appropriations requests from the six biggest agencies and extrapolated and said, you know, if they're asking for this, then all the agencies together would be asking for $99 billion. So,
and we have 72.
Have the agencies already put in their requests, though?
Yeah, the requests came in all
during
the summer
and fall. And so that's the 99.
Right. Yeah. So, but plus the argument against these is that, well, the agencies all ask for new chairs and, you know, cars and all kinds of stuff, and they're not going to allow that anyway. It ought to be lower than that. So the number on the other side is if you were spending the same amount that you spent in the current budget, then the shortfall would be in the $15 to $16 billion
range.
Right. But because of entitlements, we won't be spending the same amount, right? Because of education, because of Medicaid.
Yeah, there's more kids to educate. There's more people who are eligible for Medicaid. There are the costs of various services inside of education and Medicaid, utilization rates, they call them, have gone up. So population and inflation growth, if you account for those, then you get a bigger budget than the one we're in right now. The bottom line here is that unless you agree on how much we should be spending, you don't agree on how big the shortfall is.
And what? And we'll get the baseline budget in about a week, Speaker Strauss said today. With the budget written out, with all these cuts, or however you want to phrase them, already thought out, because it will only take into account available revenue. So the baseline budget comes out with available revenue, and that's it.
Right.
And doesn't include the rainy day fund. So the rainy day fund is kind of the big bargaining chip. And all these things, you know, the baseline budget cuts everybody. Lawmakers can go in and say, well, you know, we actually would like to cut this a little less, this a little more, and here we can use the rainy day fund.
Right. The big three, Dewhurst, Perry, and Strauss, had their press conference Wednesday morning where they basically said, we want to cut programmatically and not kind of across the board, but we did it before in 2003. We can do it again.
They were very carefully in specific.
Right. Yeah. But I did think it was interesting. Reeve, you talked about the wonky Ogden speech yesterday. A lot of people took away from that speech that Ogden basically said we needed to, quote, fix, and by fix the margins tax, he meant change it so that we raise revenue.
Well, its problem is that it doesn't bring in the revenue it's supposed to bring in. So fixing it, you would think, would mean making it bring in more revenue,
right,
which it was originally designed to do.
And Perry,
we asked the governor about it this morning. He was
open to it, right?
He said, I'm not going to get into semantics on this. So the question, they've said no new taxes. So the question was, do you consider it new taxes if you change an existing tax like franchise in order to bring in more revenue than it brings in now?
Or if you get rid of exemptions with sales tax.
And if you get rid of exemptions. And he said, well, I'm not going to get into the semantics, and I'm not going to stand up here at this podium and write legislation for you guys. So they didn't want to get into specifics yet. But you know, what they're setting up here is the controller comes in with a revenue estimate. They come in with a budget that fits the revenue estimate. That's the worst budget we're going to see because it's going to get better from here. So they come in and basically, you know, analogy would be they come in and they take hostages. And then during the course of the legislative session, they release hostages. Well, we're not going to cut this that much, so we'll release a hostage. So they, you know, hopefully look like saviors that are working their way out of a hole instead of people that are cutting programs.
Well, and I heard somebody say, the $27 billion figure that the Center for Public Policy Priorities has is disputed by conservatives. But I heard somebody in the press corps room mention that, at the end of the legislative session when they pass a budget, the big three will all claim that they were able to shrink a $27 billion budget hole.
Right, because you're going to use the bigger number to
exactly
brag about.
What happened with 2003. Yeah. 2003, the word up front was it's a $10 billion shortfall, and they said, it's not that big. And just like Ben says, when they got out of it, it's like, you know, we confronted a $10 billion shortfall.
Right. For the history books, it's going to be the larger number either way.
Right.
No, I didn't know if Reeve was Reeve looked at me, and I didn't know if he was going to say something. So
I don't think he was. Reeve, were you going to say something?
You get a certain kind of look from that chair from somebody with a tie on, and right. It's like Evan, and he's going
to
talk.
No, if you'd like me to say something, I'm happy to. That's why I'm here.
This is going well.
All right, well, then why don't we switch over to your topic, Reeve, which is...
That's what I was trying to get you to do.
Right. All along. So Perry designated eminent domain legislation and sanctuary cities, or bills that deal with or try to abolish so-called sanctuary cities, as emergency items. This allows the legislature to take up these items or bills that fall under these categories earlier than the calendar allows. Sanctuary cities is something that Reeve and Matt both reported on over the summer because it came up.
That's Matt Stiles.
That would be Matt
Texas
Stiles.
Tribune reporter.
Tribune reporter Matt Stiles, and my colleague. It's something that both the two of you reported on over the summer because Perry used sanctuary cities as a campaign.
Point foil with Bill White.
Right.
He was accused of
club.
Well, Perry accused Bill White of being mayor of a city that was a sanctuary city. And Bill White said, well, you're the mayor or the governor of a state that's a sanctuary state. So.
Right, and now sort of following through with his campaign rhetoric, that's one of the priorities facing the state, is that we have to get rid of these sanctuary cities. Sanctuary city has sort of long been a complicated term in that this sanctuary city is not a legal definition, so it's hard to say exactly that the city is a sanctuary city or not, because that term sort of is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
And now, yet when you go back and look at some of these... I mean, I think Austin's been considered a sanctuary city, but there's no actual city. There's no city ordinance that says.
Well, and in the case of Houston, which we reported about and sort of mentioned over and over, was that the Houston policy is really no different from the state's DPS policy with regard to dealing with illegal immigrants.
So cut this down. Tell me what a sanctuary city is. I mean,
a sanctuary city is, as he said this morning in the press conference, a sanctuary city is a city that provides haven to illegal immigrants, basically. Right. You know, the law won't go looking for them, which the issue is, it's basically immigration generally is a federal issue. Federal law enforcement agents have to take care of it. That's true sort of anywhere in the state. But I found the DPS policy is that the DPS basically, they won't conduct road checks or business and residence searches unless assisting appropriate federal officers when it comes to checking on immigration status.
So with being a sanctuary city, I mean, are you going to get that label if you do things like you don't ask immigration status of people you arrest? You don't. I mean, there's some jails.
Right.
Over the last couple of years.
There's this police order in Houston that's often cited that's actually been updated. But the one that gets cited is this one that says the police officers will not ask someone their immigration status when they stop them. But now what they do, when they bring someone to jail, everyone gets their immigration status checked.
Right, and if they're found, and Anise Parker, current mayor of Houston, has said, if we find you to be illegal, then we send you straight to the feds.
But you can't just walk up to someone and say, you know, it's a show me your papers.
And you can't do it at a traffic stop. You know, you were speeding, and can I see your papers?
Well, I wonder, though, if this is going to go even further. I mean, are you considered a sanctuary city if your local school district allows an undocumented child to come to school?
Right. What's your definition? There's no clear legal.
That's one of the studies in the intern was, determine how many undocumented students we have in our Texas school system.
Right.
I mean, there are some cities in the country that have sort of openly said that they want to be friendly to immigrants and they're going to be more active about it. But generally, sanctuary city is sort of a boogeyman type term.
And
if we don't like your city, you are a sanctuary city kind of thing.
And this goes to what Perry said this morning. I mean, you know, he was asked, are there any sanctuary cities in the state? And he said, well, you know, and what he seemed to be saying was basically, I don't know that if there are any or not. He didn't say it that way. But if there are, this would stop them. There are some cities. What do you say? There are some cities that I would consider to be out of compliance with what we think is right.
And then he basically said, you know, if you're one of those cities and the shoe fits, you don't want to be wearing it. So,
right, but which cities are there?
He
named no specifics. He even stopped short of calling Houston a sanctuary city. He said, they had some inappropriate policies. But these inappropriate policies that Perry considers, you know, Houston to have are materially the same as the DPS policy, which is we don't ask about immigration status on routine patrols.
If you think that Perry is running for something further, I mean, it worked in this last campaign. It seems to be like a good pet issue for him.
Yeah, it's red meat, right.
It's hard to imagine it being the priority of the state.
Well, the other thing here is that if you, you know, the Arizona legislation that we've talked a lot about, the Arizona immigration legislation, the flashpoint in that legislation was a requirement that police in Arizona, when they suspect that someone is an illegal immigrant, check their papers. So under this emergency order, that's the sort of thing that could be considered here. I was surprised that voter ID wasn't in the emergency legislation. I understand that it may be here pretty soon. So he's got time to add these things. You know, these things aren't, you know, they call them emergencies because that's the language in the Constitution. They're clearly not emergencies, and I don't think the governor's office would defend them as emergencies. But this 60-day period during which the legislature can't do anything unless the governor says so gives him a great opportunity to spotlight issues he wants to talk about. Eminent domain, you know, he did that veto almost 4 years ago that he's been trying to get out from under ever since, and it sounds like they've got agreed to legislation, at least on the House side. And this sanctuary city immigration stuff, you know, gives them a chance to highlight issues.
So do we know, a lot of times when you have an emergency item, you already know three or four bills that are associated with that item. Do we know a sanctuary city bill that's associated with
this?
Debbie
Riddle has filed one, but Perry declined to name any sort of specific legislation that he would support or proposals even that he would like to see in legislation.
Well,
so
Right.
And obviously, I haven't read the bill, so I'm, you know, I don't mean to embarrass any of us, but has anyone read the bill? Do we know what Randy was saying about this?
They haven't been specific enough yet. I mean, if they want a piece of legislation that says we're not going to allow sanctuary cities in Texas and they're defined this way, that's one piece of legislation. If they're instead going to do some version of the Arizona immigration law where they require police to
ask
for papers in traffic stops and those kinds of things, that would also fit in some ways under this emergency order. We don't know which way he's going.
Right, and Perry has said before that he does not think that the Arizona law is right for Texas.
But he has also said that I think there might be some version of that that would be right for Texas.
Well, this is why I think this is interesting, because what's going to wind up on his desk? Because I think that given the supermajority in the House and the big majority in the Senate, we are likely to see tougher immigration, you know, state immigration proposals wind up on the desk of the governor. Now, if that's the case, what will Perry be okay with? And is he going to be, you know, having to deal with this towards the back end? Or is the office and their liaisons, are they going to negotiate this during the process? So it'll be interesting to watch.
And, you know, I brought up Riddle earlier. I mean, one of her bills deals with illegal immigration and the public school system. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so how are these going to all mesh together?
Yeah, it depends on what he says he's going to allow in under this banner. You know, that's where the governor can control legislation to some extent. So, yeah, not that one. You're getting warmer. On the other one, the eminent domain thing, he pointed to a bill and said, I've been working with, you know, these guys and these guys and these guys. And, you know,
Charlie Guerin
and someone else.
And one of the senators.
Hager, maybe?
Maybe.
One of the senators.
But he pointed to specific.
That's why we should allow more notes in these trip tests.
Yeah, exactly. There will be a test. He pointed to specific legislation on the eminent domain stuff, but has remained sort of vague on the sanctuary cities. So.
All right. So for our final topic, I was hoping that we could kind of just go around the circle with our observations from covering the ledge these last 2 days that we've been back in session. Any sort of interesting things you've noticed, changes from previous sessions? Obviously, tighter security was sort of a story.
You took mine.
Oh, okay. Reeve, you go first.
Tighter security. The security has been tighter.
We still have the metal detectors in the galleries that keep you from taking a gun into the gallery. So you can't sit on the second floor over the House or over the Senate with a gun in your hand. But down at the front door, the fastest way through the metal detectors is to have a concealed gun permit. And in fact, you can carry a gun into the building. It's just, it's weird that we have the security system where we have to have two checkpoints in order that, you know, the first one lets you through fast if you have a gun and the second one stops you if you have a gun. That's new.
My observation, just being on the House floor, is how many new faces there really are. On the first day, you know, family members are allowed onto the floor, and I really couldn't tell at some point whether somebody was a husband or it was Jim Landrup. You know, I mean,
it's a quarter of the House.
He actually is also a husband.
Right.
As it turns out,
another funny thing:
a quarter of the people in the House are new. So, you know, we always have this phenomenon at the end of the session. You can sit in the House all session. And some people are just quiet all session. Somebody will go to the back mic on the last day, and everybody on the press table will go, "Who is that?"
Mm-hmm.
And this is weird on the first day to have so many people that are candidates for that. You just we don't know who's going to shine and who's not. Right now, they're just a bunch of strangers.
Of course, we only have two new people in the Senate, and that's where I was yesterday. So that wasn't exciting.
You were able to spot them immediately.
Immediately.
All right. Good.
Ben, anything you noticed?
I don't know. I had a conversation with a lawmaker in the hallway just about, you know, the speaker's race. Who's the House member, and you know, just saying, boy, I hope they don't take too much heat for. Is a Republican, you know, hope they don't take too much heat for voting for Strauss. But you know, it'll be interesting to see how it kind of plays out. Will Strauss do something else to kick the hornet's nest, or will the Tea Party come up with something that Strauss has done to simulate a hornet nest kicking? He's going to come out in a couple weeks with the committee assignments. I think Tea Party people, the people that have been supporting Ken Paxton, will probably go completely bonkers if 70% of the committees aren't given to Republican chairs. And honestly, you probably come out with 63% or 66% and everyone will go crazy. But
speaking of the speakers, I did think that the Jason Isaac basically got in this situation where, like a lot of the freshman representatives that were elected with this sort of go in there and be conservative Tea Party supporters, he told his district, and he thinks his district did not want Strauss for speaker, and he told them he wouldn't vote for him. And then But he really wanted to vote for someone. He didn't want to be against someone, especially didn't want to be against someone that was going to be in power later on. So he went in, and then there was no one to vote for but Strauss. So he just voted for his first vote. He voted just present.
Yeah.
Right.
I abstain.
Right,
I
he abstain.
Yeah, run away.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah, and you know what I just realized is that in the Big Three press conference Wednesday morning, none of us asked or got an answer from Strauss on when his committee chairs and committee choices are going to come out. I guess we're going to expect them around the same time as usual, mid-February.
I assume sooner than last time.
I went and looked for last time. Last time they were actually a little early. Both Dewhurst and Strauss had their chairman out by the end of January.
Okay.
Oh, I thought Strauss was late because it was kind of a last second.
I did too, which is why I went and looked it up.
Huh,
they were up pretty quick.
So it'll be interesting to see, you know, whether that sort of sows the seeds of fratricide and all the things that we've been expecting, because there have been differences on both sides. But the Tea Party filled the gallery on opening day for the speaker vote.
And they had extra security up there.
That's true. And, you know, no noise, nothing really.
I'm still waiting to see if these guys are a big political force or just a loud one. I mean, they didn't turn this game. I mean, for all the noise from the election day to the speaker vote, they got 15 votes.
If you go all the way back to the primary, also we have the same sort of more moderate speaker that we have. We also have more moderate State Board of Education.
Right.
You know, I don't know where has it gotten us. Yeah. It's a valid question.
All right. If you have any questions or comments for us at the Tribcast, you can email us at podcasts@texastribune.org. For now, on behalf of Ross, Ben, Reeve, and Todd, our producer, I'm Elise. Thanks for listening.